You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the early 20th century, when scientists had only a limited ability to observe wild animals in their natural habitats, many thought that taxidermy might be the best way to preserve species that could soon become extinct. University of Pennsylvania creative writing professor Jay Kirk has written a book called Kingdom Under Glass, a tale of obsession, adventure, and one man's quest to preserve the world's great animals. It's about Carl Akerley, who was perhaps the most famous taxidermist of the time. And the book is published by Henry Holt. I'm very pleased to welcome Professor Kirk to our show. Hello.
Hi, thank you.
Today, stuffing dead animals doesn't strike me as the best approach to environmental preservation. Was it thought then that you had to kill the animal to save it?
I certainly wouldn't go that far. I think, you know, the idea was that taxidermy was technologically the best way they had to preserve an image of these species that were considered, widely considered, to be on the brink of extinction.
Did any of them go extinct after they were preserved by people like Akerley?
Well, many had already gone extinct. I mean, the quagga and the blue antelope and many. And many were seen during the scramble for Africa, you know, during the colonization and the oversettlement and this, like, enormous hunting and overhunting that was taking place there. You know, the species were being diminished. And so when Akerley was there trying to collect elephants just over the course of 6 years between his first and second expedition, he found it much, much more difficult to even locate elephants.
Well, he got into taxidermy before he ever went to Africa in search of these animals, didn't he? Why did he start and when did he start practicing taxidermy?
Well, he started as a child. You know, it was not the most uncommon hobby for kids of the late 19th century, mid-late 19th century. Teddy Roosevelt did it. Anyone who was an aspiring naturalist probably practiced taxidermy as a child. But in Akerley's home, he was so obsessed with it that his family was really nervous about it. I mean, he had basically taken over his entire bedroom with dead animals. He could go around the corner to Bishop's drugstore and pick up arsenic and strychnine and all of these poisons that he used, which he'd found the method for taxidermy in this taxidermist manual advertised in the back of Youth's Companion. It was kind of like Boy's Life of its time. And so he's up there disassembling and reassembling all these dead animals, and the smell and, you know, the morbidity coming from his bedroom freaked his parents out, but especially his aunt, who actually tried to persuade his mother to send him to an asylum, a mental asylum, because she thought it was such a problem.
But then he earned money for the work. Did that change things?
Well, what changed things with the aunt was that she forgot to put the drape back over her bird cage one evening, and her beloved canary dropped dead, and then he brought it back to life. He mounted it for her, and she was, I guess that put that question to rest. But then, yeah, I mean, he started making money from it.
Was he just like every other taxidermist, or did he develop new techniques?
He eventually developed new techniques. He was lucky enough that he was only he grew up in a small town called Clarendon, New York, which was only 20 miles away from Rochester. Now, in Rochester, which was where there was a place called Ward's Natural Science Establishment, which was kind of this great emporium where they were preparing not only stuffed animals and dioramas as such, but, you know, meteorites and fossils and lots of exhibits for the new up-and-coming natural history museums, and Akerley got a job there. Once he arrived, he quickly became disillusioned with the level of artistry that was being used or the lack of artistry that was being used to stuff these animals, because they were literally being stuffed. You would take the skin and stuff it, you know, create a rough armature of the dimensions of the animal and stuff it with sawdust or rags or whatever you had around the studio. And he felt like it could probably be much better. And to that end, he began studying, you know, anatomy books and other things.
Well, those stuffed animals would deteriorate in time, wouldn't they?
Yes, absolutely. They did not. They were not durable. They were not that lasting.
What about the lifelike displays of stuffed animals in their natural habitats? When did he begin to think that would be a good way of practicing his art?
Well, this sort of went hand in hand with the new concept of ecology which had just come about, this idea that there was an interrelationship, a dynamic interrelationship between organisms and their natural habitat, that animals did not exist within, you know, a vacuum, which you would see in a lot of the older natural history museums, just an animal in a glass box without any leaves or any attempt at a semblance of a habitat.
Did he invent the diorama as we know it?
He didn't. No, he did not invent the diorama. And there had been previous attempts doing this. One of his predecessors at Ward's Natural Science Establishment, William Hornaday, who went on to be a director of the American Museum of Natural History, had actually a few years before Akeley's great breakthrough had created something that resembled that, you know, by using clay and to make the animals in a more, you know, more natural.
So when Akeley was putting together these displays, was he responsible for every aspect of the diorama? Did he hire the painters?
Ultimately, yes. He ended up getting fired from Ward's, first of all, and then he thought his career was done. You know, he was kind of at the top of his game, and then he ended up going to Brooklyn in exile and just stuffing birds for what was then the big haute couture of women wearing dead birds on their hats, which for him was a total purgatory. Soon, though, he came back to Rochester. He got his job back.
You mentioned Brooklyn, and I know that there seems to be some kind of a renaissance of taxidermy with taxidermists popping up in Brooklyn. Is there some connection between Brooklyn and taxidermy?
I have no idea. Yeah, there seems to be like a very, you know, kind of a hip taxidermy thing going on right now, and I have to say I greatly admire it, but I don't practice it, and I don't know that much about it.
What led you to tell the story of Carl Akeley? You're a professor of creative writing, not of history or of anything else that I might associate with taxidermy.
No. I mean, I'm mainly a nonfiction writer, and the idea of writing a book about Akeley came to me while I was working on a piece for Harper's Magazine about extinct mountain lions, a.k.a. the puma cougar, which used to be the most widespread mammal in North America. And then it was wiped out in the east. The eastern mountain lion was exterminated by 1888. And I was doing a piece where there were all of these sightings. I'm talking about today, all of these sightings all over the east of the eastern puma, sort of like Elvis sightings. And so I was kind of grabbed by that. I like idiosyncratic pieces along that lines. And while I was reading about the history, the more serious part of it, not the cryptozoological aspect of the story, but the historical, kind of extermination of not only the cougar, but of the wolves and the bison and all of America's great wilderness, I read something in passing about Carl Akeley, this famous taxidermist who had once strangled a leopard with his bare hands. And when I read that, I was just, you know, smitten. I had to find out more.
He also worked for P.T. Barnum. He stuffed Jumbo, didn't he, after Jumbo was killed?
Yeah, that was his first sort of claim to fame. He was still working at Ward's when that happened. And Ward, his employer, and P.T. Barnum were friends. And Barnum had won Jumbo over from the British once Jumbo actually started suffering from what is called must, which is a period of maturation in the elephant where they can appear psychotic. And he was, you know, he'd smashed his tusks through the wall of his cage. And anyway, it was a huge debacle. But P.T. Barnum got a hold of Jumbo, brought him over, and then soon, unfortunately, while they were on tour, Jumbo got into a head-on collision with a train and was killed. And Akeley went and picked up the pieces and then brought it back and mounted Jumbo phenomenally. So P.T. Barnum actually asked if the skin could be stretched out to make Jumbo appear larger than he had in life. And Akeley just sort of shrugged and said, okay.
So P.T. Barnum made money from Jumbo when he was alive and made money from Jumbo when he was dead.
When Jumbo was dead, he continued to lead the circus, attended by Alice, his grieving widow, who wore black.
My guest is Jay Kirk, whose book Kingdom Under Glass, A Tale of Obsession, Adventure, and One Man's Quest to Preserve the World's Great Animals is published by Henry Holt. When did he decide that he had to go out and kill the animals that he was going to be stuffing?
His first expedition to he had his first kind of megalomaniac, maniacal vision of recreating all of the mammalian life of Wisconsin, but that was kind of shelved.
Why Wisconsin?
Because he was at the Milwaukee Public Museum. But then he ended up working for the Field Museum in Chicago, which was brand new. And the director there, Daniel Giraud Elliott, who had been one of the early founders of the American Museum of Natural History in New York and had actually gone on the American Museum's first expedition in 1888 to collect endangered bison from North Dakota. So this whole idea of collecting endangered species was part of their MO from the very beginning.
So he wasn't just looking for trophies like other people who went on safari.
No, not at all. The idea was that they were collecting samples of species, voucher species. It was very fatalistic. They wanted to collect species because they sincerely believed they were going to go extinct, and so this would be an image that, you know, we now today would be able to look at and say, oh, that's sad, we lost that. When the camera came along, that changed a lot, and Akeley had a hand in that as well.
Well, you mentioned that he strangled a leopard with his bare hands. How did that happen, and is that leopard on display anywhere?
I believe the skin ended up as a rug for a friend of his.
A few years later, he was attacked by a bull elephant.
Yes.
He'd always feared that sort of thing happening.
He certainly thought about it a lot, and I think if you're in the habit of hunting elephants, that is probably at the forefront of your mind, from what I understand and the many safari memoirs that I read. Hunting elephants is not good for your health.
You mentioned that his aunt thought he was crazy. His parents were not happy about his taxidermy. What about his wife, Mickey? Didn't she also have problems with his taxidermy work?
No.
Well, at one point, she almost left him. She said that
absolutely.
A monkey was the only one who really, truly understood her.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
They had a live monkey in the house?
It's sad. I mean, they had this wonderful romance, but I would have to say that safari life is just not the best thing for one's mental well-being. While they were on it, they went on four expeditions together. I mean, death-defying trips. And over again, you know, after he was injured by this bull elephant that you mentioned, he was convalescing in his cot for 3 months. He'd been scalped. His ribs were busted. His face had been torn open. And, you know, instead of going back to America to a clean hospital with running water, et cetera, he stayed on in his tent. And while he was recovering, Mickey took care of everything. I mean, she was his nurse. She saved his life over and over again. She sacrificed an enormous amount for him. And then in the end, well, not in the end, but I mean, she did adopt this monkey. Its name was JT Jr. She actually wrote a book about it called JT Jr. Biography of an African Monkey. And it was certainly one of my favorite primary sources. It was on their 1909 expedition. And over lunch one day at one of these classic safari-style lunches at a table out in the grass, they were having an argument about the morality of keeping animals in captivity. And the men she was with, including Akeley, were saying that they felt that monkeys were filthy little beasts. They'd been talking about zoos, so that was really all they knew. And Mickey was saying that the filthiness of monkeys was only because they were in zoos, they were in captivity, and they had lost their sense of morale. And so to prove this, she went out, she captured a little vervet monkey, brought it back, was going to demonstrate that it was clean and its natural, you know, condition, and then quickly fell in love with it, named it, kept it, and it joined the safari. And then soon Carl found that he was no longer welcome to Mickey's cot at night. Because it could get very cold in the highlands of British East Africa, but also because she was intent on conducting scientific experiments and documenting it. So she wanted to record the night sounds that the monkey would make at night.
He also went on safari with Theodore Roosevelt.
Teddy Roosevelt, yes. He persuaded Roosevelt to come over to Africa to go elephant hunting.
So you mentioned that he played a role in the development of photography and movie cameras?
Yes, yes. On that same 1909-1911 expedition, he had brought with him a motion picture camera. It was a British-made urban bioscope, which was this very cumbersome thing. It was basically like a big wooden suitcase mounted to a tripod, and it just wasn't very reactive. He was constantly frustrated with trying to film anything more fleet-footed than a hippopotamus. And so when he returned to America, and it was during the war, he was working on his elephants. And in his spare time, he started reinventing the motion picture camera. And he added a number of kind of phenomenal, made a number of very interesting innovations to the camera. One, the biggest one probably, is that he created a gyroscopic hinge between the camera and the tripod, and a single handle to control the pan and tilt. So it just had just this enormous panoramic fluidity for, you know, you could go full vertical, horizontal, diagonal, and you could follow anything very quickly. He made it round, and it was made out of metal. A lot of things at that point were being made out of metal instead of wood. And then it went on to – it was used in a lot of early Hollywood action scenes like The Chariot Race in Ben-Hur. Robert Flaherty used it to film Nanook of the North and praised its great durability in those harsh conditions. When people watched The Man o' War at the Kentucky Derby in the newsreels, they were flabbergasted. They had no idea how it was filmed, but they had two Akeley cameramen positioned at either side of the racetrack. But people thought that the camera must have been attached to an airplane or a car speeding around the track.
Tell us about the epiphany that Akeley had while he was hunting mountain gorillas.
This was in 1921. The mountain gorilla was still a relatively newly discovered species. It took him, it was very difficult for him to get into the Virungas where he found these. And at the same time, you know, I have to say, compared to the trophy hunters that were out there at the day, Akeley was a paragon of biocentric thinking. You know, I'm the Prince of Sweden at that time had shot 14 mountain gorillas. You know, it wasn't unheard of to go shoot 80 lions without thinking. So Akeley was in the Virungas. He encountered the mountain gorilla, and he was persuaded that there were really only a few hundred of them there. I mean, even today, there's only 750, and Akeley was right. But I think that kind of partition between him and nature shattered or melted, and he kind of saw that he was connected to the mountain gorilla, and he really felt like a murderer when he killed it. And that led to his epiphany, which led him to spending a great deal of effort to persuade the Belgian government, who ran the Congo, to create what would become Africa's very first wildlife sanctuary, which without a question saved the mountain gorilla.
So he was responsible for wildlife sanctuaries, also for the African Room at the American Museum of Natural History?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, his legacy is it's an interesting legacy. You know, he was a hunter. And I mean, I love the dioramas he created. I think with a grain of salt, when you go in there, it's phenomenal.
Well, they're being redone now, but it's been a long time. Recently, there's talk about upgrading them.
Well, I know some museums have done that. I don't know about the African Hall. I think they're pretty happy with the way it is now. But certainly, like the Smithsonian has gotten rid of a lot of their dioramas in favor of more high-tech edutainment type things.
Jay Kirk's book, Kingdom Under Glass, A Tale of Obsession, Adventure, and One Man's Quest to Preserve the World's Great Animals, is published by Henry Holt. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.